Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
I'm speaking with Lois McMaster-Bujold, the author of a series of science fiction novels based on the origins and adventures of Miles Naismith Vorkosigan. Ms. Bujold is the recipient of numerous of the highest awards of science fiction, including two Nebula and four Hugo Awards. Her novels have most recently been published by, have been generally published by Bain Books, which she has grown along with over the years from it was a small publishing firm when she first joined it. And, I welcome you, Ms. Bujold.
Thank you. Hi there. Glad to be here.
I thought of you as a pretty inspiring example of someone who took up writing later, after not having seen herself as a serious writer in the first part of your life, especially with a two-year-old and four-year-old at home. You were living in Ohio, and what inspired you to become a novelist?
Well, actually, it's a misnomer to say that I started at age 33. I actually started probably at age 14. I was trying to write all through junior high and high school and my early college years. And somewhere in my 20s, I sort of lost track of myself for about a decade until I had started my family. So I had a lot of like early experiences with trying to start up a writing career much too young, without a really solid center to write out of. I think my early sort of juvenilia was very reflective. It was sort of taking in all the kind of reading that I loved and sort of turning it around and putting it back out again, which is what you do at that age. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I found I had more original stories to tell. But essentially my initial drive was economic. I was stuck in Marion, Ohio in 1982 in the middle of the Reagan recession, and there were no jobs. So I was never in the situation of having to quit wanting to write and then quit my day job because I couldn't get a day job in the first place. And a friend of mine from back in high school had started writing again, once again after she had completed her family, and had made a few short story sales, so she was my kind of direct inspiration. It was like, we used to do this together. Maybe I can do it again.
That's great. And you've written about 15 novels now?
Approximately, yeah. I think I'm working on my 14th at the moment.
Okay. And do you have a timeline in mind for your writing career? Is the current series of novels that you're writing with indefinitely, or do you want to branch out another genre?
I'd like to do it all, but there won't be time. since I write a book every year, a year and a half, I have to pick and choose. I would like to pursue my series with centering on Miles Vorkosigan and his universe because it's a great deal of fun and I have an enormous emotional investment in it by this time. But I also want to do other things as well, if for no other reason than to keep my brain refreshed so that I can bring, the best possible work to the series.
Well, what are some of the trade-offs of writing in a consistent universe rather than writing a series of one-offs?
There's a certain scope available. There is a kind of ability to do themes and sub-themes that reflect on one another. If you compare a novel to a short story, one of the things that you can do in a novel that you can't do in a short story is have subplots that examine different aspects of theme and kind of reflect them back and forth to one another. And I've discovered this pattern also works in the larger series of novels. You can discuss one aspect of the human condition and then come take another slice on it with the next book, and the books begin to comment on one another as well. So there's a kind of thematic charm to that is available at that scale. As far as world building goes, which is of course a big concern in science fiction, it allows me to build a larger, more detailed, more convincing world, which a lot of science fiction readers really enjoy. They enjoy getting into the details of the world building and comparing and contrasting and thinking about all the different aspects that the scope of something that size allows one to present.
You participate pretty actively online with your readership. Do they give you a lot of feedback about consistencies or directions?
Oh, they're very good at consistencies. They are gimlet-eyed, I think, is the word for it. if I make one little mistake in a million words, they will pick it up and gleefully tell me about it. Hmm. But that's just part of the game. I don't object to that. means they're paying close attention, which is extremely flattering.
Right. Your novels have been very fascinating to me from a bioethics point of view, and I first was caught by Falling Free, which is about a group of space workers who are genetically engineered to have two extra arms in place of their legs, and then when the evil corporation decides they're expendable, they rebel. And you've given a lot of thought in your novels to the use of genetics to create slaves, prostitutes, expendable clones, and to control civilizations. And yet you also have civilizations like Beta Colony where genetics are, for the most part, for the good, and the products of genetics have equal rights. Is there an explicit bioethical content to your writing? Is it as explicit as it seems to me with the kind of background I have?
I'm not sure explicit. It's implicit, in that I'm looking for strong stories to tell with, you know, with strong emotional underpinnings. Moral issues work like that for me. And I think bioethics throws up really, really interesting moral dilemmas that one can write exciting stories about. So it's purely literary. In another, that my background is in biology. I was a biology major in college, and I worked for 10 years at a university hospital as a pharmacy technician, rather low technical level, but I did a lot of unconscious observing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole biological and medical thing is very deeply ingrained in me. That kind of thought comes easily to me.
As a mother, you have obviously...
Yeah, that too.
in your novels, you reflect on uterine replicators as a pretty unalloyed good in the universe. Is that something that you think we can and should move towards?
I don't think there is such a thing as an unalloyed good. It is as usual, a mixed blessing. Uterine replicator, which is the idea of gestating children entirely outside the human body... First of all, it would drop the maternal mortality and morbidity rate to zero instantly. I mean, this is an unarguable good. But it would also create opportunities for certain kinds of exploitation and abuse. So you're going to get, you know, you're going to get both. You're going to get some good aspects of it, and you're going to get some less good aspects of it.
Mm.
As it now stands, every time a human being is born, they have to go through whatever... editing or moral stand the woman who bears it will make. If you have uterine replicators, you can do all kinds of experimenting without anybody putting down their foot and saying, no way, you're not doing this with my body or my kid.
We don't have to police women's wombs.
No, not at this time. Well, we do a little, but not at this time. And this will become be something that we've never had to pay attention to before, that we will have to pay attention to explicitly in the legal system.
Mm-hmm.
And this, by the way, is a technology that is going to be developed. It's not nearly as far future as my books would suggest. I think this is one of the coming things.
Right. Actually, the Japanese have made some recent success.
Yeah.
Your novels actually, to my mind, don't represent a terribly far-flung set of propositions scientifically and technically. Of course, there's the problem of actually getting through wormholes in faster than light travel, which is endemic. But in terms of the day-to-day science and technology in people's lives, you haven't really gone very far afield.
My books are not rigorous futurism in the broad scheme. For one thing, underlying the entire Miles series is the notion of quick, easy interstellar transport, which is, as far as we know, never going to be possible. So that knocks out a certain amount of underpinning right there. But in the details, in the biological, for example, details, other details of the plot, then I can get down to something a little more rigorous in the way of projection. I'm not especially interested in cybernetics. So I haven't pursued that. I am, as I say, far more interested in biology, and so those are the aspects of science that I usually hang my plots on front and center.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of traditional science fiction background where you have the interstellar travel and the assorted planets, you know, spread out with various cultures, acts, I think, as a kind of thought experiment. It allows us to do little cultural thought experiments about how people will live. It is really a kind of literary landscape or a thought landscape rather than a rigorous futuristic extrapolation.
part of the reason for the technological level that you describe is because the principal culture that you describe, Beriar, is actually a kind of neo-feudal patriarchal mm-hmm. culture building back up from a period of isolation. What was the decision? That's pretty much a staple in kind of space opera, the idea mm-hmm. of neo-feudal civilizations out there. And I think you do a really good job of portraying a society where honor, service, and heroism are taken pretty seriously. But you also have characters in your novels who come from more enlightened societies and who refer to that society as a backward dirt ball and mm-hmm. And so forth, including Miles's mother. What's been your thinking about the depiction of political alternatives in your different civilizations?
Well, I have them. You know, this is not a uniform world. If we think back, for example, to Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, where he had this enormous galactic culture that was absolutely uniform all the way across, this is kind of the counter to that. You know, I assume that human beings will not be less various than they are here and now, and somewhere there's something for everyone, and that all blessings are mixed, all political systems have their pros and cons. And so we don't have good and evil, we have various mixtures of choices that people can make in the different cultures, and then I let them sort of play out and see what are the logical consequences of this set of choices. The Beriar itself, as a kind of neo-feudal society trying to catch up with a future that's moving much too fast, is kind of a metaphor for ourselves in the 20th century. There, you know, a lot of the problems they face are the problems we face as technologies come down on them unasked, and they have to adjust and change.
A lot of Miles's characterological work has to do with his own aristocratic background, his status as a disabled person in a very regressive, reactionary society that doesn't look well on disabled people.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a pretty much conscious decision to not have him spend a lot of time on Beta Colony, where all of his problems would be pretty much moot?
Kind of, yeah. It's like Miles grew. He was not, you know, he was not so much consciously assembled as that he appeared and then just kept growing. He originally came out of the situation of his parents. We have his father, Errol Vorkosigan, who is a member of the feudal culture. His mother, Cordelia, who is a member of the Baton Enlightened culture. And the question is, having gotten married to live happily ever after on Beriar, which of course did not work out, the question for the author's point of view is, what's the worst possible thing that I can do to these characters that would give them an interesting story? And that was, in their context, to have a handicapped child in this Beriar culture.
Hmm.
So with that premise, everything else sort of followed semi-logically.
And the role of women, of course, is also part of this, and you're one of the most prominent of women science fiction writers nowadays. You have a couple novels where women play central roles. One, Ethan of Athos, where Ellie Quinn, mm-hmm. Miles' sometimes girlfriend, is central to that. But in general, Cordelia, your first series of novels, the very first novels you wrote, had Cordelia as a kind of quiet, strong central presence who wins her role in a patriarchal culture by being a better warrior than everyone else around her.
Mm-hmm.
But have you caught much flack about the fact that you have centered most of your novels on men, and that you seem very involved with male characterological issues, and there aren't very many depictions of egalitarian gender relations?
I disagree. I think it's all there implicitly. Whenever you have a viewpoint character, the universe centers itself around that viewpoint character. Since I have mostly used Miles Vorkosigan as my viewpoint character, and his context is to struggle mostly with masculine issues, except not always, that we have that kind of centering. But whenever you switch to one of the female viewpoint characters, which I do in Falling Free, which I do, which I've just done in Kamar, where the viewpoint is split between male character and a female character.
I haven't gotten to that yet.
Okay. Well, Kamar is sort of the rebuttal of this whole conversation.
Okay.
it kind of gets back to doing some female issues.
Okay, good.
I will put in a quibble at the moment that the way people define male and female issues, I kind of disagree with in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
For example, defining all military activity as male is questionable.
Well, certainly you have gender integrated militaries, and you make a strong case for them as well.
Right. Yeah. If nothing else, the civilian population is always going to be 50-50 that the war passes over. War is a woman's issue.
Mm-hmm. Your depiction of Jackson's Hole as a kind of libertarian outpost strikes me because there's a lot of explicit and implicit libertarianism, anti-government attitudes in contemporary science fiction, and your novels seem to at least implicitly make a pretty strong statement that a society without governance but with just the market would end up doing some pretty terrible things versus the societies that have governance. Is that something that you've given some thought to?
I think so. I picture Jackson's Hole as having been settled by libertarian space pirates.
Right.
And the consequences that follow to be logical. My own view of governments is that all governments are imaginary. They are things that we make up as kind of mental maps to get around and manipulate the world. All governments, without exception. So we can change these maps around, and we can do, all kinds of different things with them. A lot of people conceive of governments as having, and corporations for that matter, as having a real existence. The government is out there doing things, thinking things, making choices. Well, that's simply not real. That's not the way it actually works. It's a lot of people making a lot of choices that kind of average out to this or that result, which may or may not be planned or desirable.
Your novels, I'm sorry to jump around with the different topics, but I've just been reading for the last 3 months in your series from the beginning of the chronological order to the Miles universe to the present up to Kumar. And I know that that's one of the debates among your followers, whether you should read it in the order that you wrote them.
Perpetual debate.
Yeah. One of the issues that strikes me is that you have not introduced aliens, robots, artificial intelligence, or human beings who are radically different from what we would expect into your novels. Has that been a decision as well about whether how easy it is to relate to a character who is so radically different or to describe the perspective of such a character?
The decision to eliminate aliens was made probably back in Shards of Honor, my very first novel. I decided that Miles' timeline, that future, will be a bioengineering future, and that the kind of beginnings of human speciation that we are seeing in Miles' time with the Quaddies, with Tara the super soldier, and with other characters, Belle Thorne the hermaphrodite, is something that will be going on in his timeline, although past his time, and 10,000 years down the timeline in his universe, the aliens will be us. So that is kind of the setup for this universe. I happen to have gotten stuck on this one character, and so we were seeing just a tiny slice out of this whole range of possibilities. If I were to jump down the timeline, Miles' timeline, a couple of thousand years, we would see a very different galactic scene in terms of the kinds of people that populated it.
Oh, that's something to look forward to.
Perhaps. Sure. I've been sort of writing his books in real time, so that would mean I'd have to live a thousand years to get there.
Yeah,
jumping around.
You tend to take a year to write a book, and each book tends to cover about a year of Miles' life.
Yeah, this is not intentional, but it seems to be working out that way. I think it's the rate at which I find new things to say.
You've recently put together an anthology, Women at War. Are you going to say something about that?
Yeah, this was an extremely interesting experience to have the kind of editorial shoe on the other foot. I think that was good for me. It is yet another Marty Greenberg anthology. Martin Greenberg is responsible for many, many anthologies of original work that you see on the shelves these days. And I kind of got hustled for it by Roland Green, to be their front woman, since they wanted to do this military SF anthology and they needed a female editor. So Roland and I worked together on it. It was a lot of fun. Roland is very much all but dissertation, military historian, PhD. Interesting from a writer's point of view to try my hand at editing. I think I helped some stories and I failed to hinder others. The stories we got were extremely interesting, and quite a variety of them. The anthology didn't sell very well. I'm not sure how it was marketed, or whether it fell between the cracks. All the women didn't want to read about war, and all the people who wanted to read about war didn't want to read about women, and assumed they were mutually exclusive, which I deny. But we got some tremendously strong stories out of it. There's one by Elizabeth Moon that ends the volume that just is, sort of sums it all up. We got an excellent story from Judith Tarr, and we got three or four people had their first story sales to that anthology, which was a lot of fun.
You've obviously got an opinion that male and female characteristics of characters are not as radically different as people sometimes think. Do you think that's also true of male and female science fiction writers? There are certainly stereotypes about the characterological and social focus of most female science fiction writers and the hard science orientation of most males.
I think that, like any stereotype, it has a grain of truth, but like any stereotype, it is actually not true. Everyone is more varied. But each writer has their particular set of interests. Ultimately I'm writing Bujold books, and, some other writer is writing their books. Kind of for each of us, that's our job, to write our own stories. And where it fits in this larger canon is pretty much has to be left to chance.
In Sita Ganda, the novel about the culture that's controlled by genetic resources, and as well a straight comment by Cordelia, I think, at one point about Beriar, you suggested that women are the guardians of the genetic resources of a race and that they have a lot of unacknowledged power as a result of that. Is that a kind of general view you have about power?
Kind of. When I look at the game of culture versus evolution, it seems to me that the women are playing the long game, although they're playing, their own little tiny parts in it. 2 million years from now, whether or not you had children is probably the only thing you're going to do that's still going to matter and be making a difference. All the culture will have been and gone. On the other hand, as far as one's personal life goes, given that we aren't going to be around 2 million years from now to enjoy the results, the culture is where the rewards and the punishments lie. So it's a trade-off. It's a conceptualization, I suppose. Valorization, perhaps, of the role of women.
There's, to my mind, a strain of very subversive sexual attitudes in your novels. And just to recount a couple, Miles' father in the very first novels you wrote is bisexual, and his mother is confronted with this and doesn't bat an eyelash and thinks it's perfectly fine because she comes from Beta Colony. And later on, she even describes her husband as not even being bisexual, but actually loving men in uniforms, and she just happened to fit into that particular stereotype for him, being a good soldier.
I think Cordelia was having a bad day that day, but yes.
And then later, Miles' clone brother, who, albeit is schizophrenic by way of torture, he is considering at the end of Mirror Dance how he can ease his girlfriend into the idea that he enjoys kinky sex with men. And then you have a hermaphrodite military officer who's in love with Miles, and of course you've written a whole novel, Ethan of Athos, which has a gay male protagonist, which I don't know of very many novels in science fiction at all. With
swimming upstream against the currents there.
Yeah. And all this is incredibly welcome, because as the gay and lesbian SF group, Galaxians, have pointed out, there's never once been a suggestion in, say, Star Wars or Star Trek that there is going to be gay desire in the future. But what's been, have you taken any flack? Have you gained a following because of this?
I haven't taken any flack, I think, because the kind of people who would be upset by that don't read science fiction in the first place. So they don't even know the books exist. So that's, I'm sort of protected from outrage by my genre barriers. As far as support, I've gained some readership. I will get, occasionally letters from gay guys. Thank you for portraying a gay man as a real human being and not as a stereotype or what have you there. But basically, my view is that people are people, whatever their form. And I start from there and go on, and the results seem to come out in ways that convince people. I get all kinds of letters not only from gays, but from handicapped people thanking me for portraying a handicapped person realistically. Say, yes, this represents my experience. I recognize this. This feels valid. I get letters from engineers thanking me for portraying an engineer mindset the way it really feels. I get letters from mothers thanking me for portraying mothers in a way that feels authentic to them. So I think what I'm doing is much broader than just portraying my gay characters. I think I'm just getting people right.
Your actually Miles's disability is based on your experience of a coworker.
Well, Miles's disability is based on a lot of things. I say, first of all, it comes out of his parents' situation.
Mm-hmm.
He does have a physical template. It was a hospital pharmacist I used to work with, from whom I stole Miles's height and leg braces and limp and the chin tick. There was also a little of T.E. Lawrence, another short, psychologically interesting soldier from history, who was part of Miles's inspiration. I take part of Miles out of myself. He has this great man son syndrome, which is one of his driving motivations, and that comes a little bit from my relationship with my father. So the character has many sources, which is probably why he's so resonant and so durable.
Your father inspired you to read science fiction in the first place, and mm-hmm. his engineering was a big influence on you.
Yes, I started reading science fiction at age 9 because the stuff was lying around the house. My father was a professor of engineering at Ohio State University for many years, welding engineering. As a matter of fact, I stole his specialty to give to Leo Graf in Falling Free. Mm. Was one of the world's foremost authorities in his field. So my childhood was spent, watching the visiting professors pass in and out of the household and hearing about the kinds of problems that he worked on. And it was pretty impressive. This was a very hard act to follow.
Mm. These novels, to me, seem eminently filmable, especially since mm-hmm. they don't... I was thinking recently of Greg Egan's novel, which is all set inside computers with virtual realities as protagonists, and I just have no idea how you would possibly film that. your novels seem very filmable to me. Have they been optioned yet?
I've had one option. Warner Brothers optioned The Warrior's Apprentice, kept the option for 3 years and then allowed it to lapse. They did produce a script, but it had almost no relationship to the book whatsoever. So I'm extremely glad that the option lapsed, because it would have been very embarrassing if they had made that film.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And I'm hoping that we can have you back on later after you... have you published your next book. Kumar is your most recent book. It's still mm-hmm. out in hardback.
Yes, it just came out in June here.
And when do you said that you're on a year schedule and you're working on another, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm probably running a little over on the years. The book that I'm currently working on is the direct sequel to Kumar. And I will, if I finish it to deadline, which I don't quite expect, it should be out in late 1999. Mm-hmm. It is my Barrier and Regency romance, which I've promised myself for years that I would write. It's been a lot of fun. I don't know what the SF crowd will make of it. That will be their problem.
Well, actually, Shards of Honor was pretty much a love story.
Mm-hmm.
And then you worked away from that, and now you're coming back to it.
Yeah, kind of. Shards of Honor was more of a gothic romance, and this is more of a romantic comedy. So it's a different take. I do a lot of subtle genre crossover work. I do science fiction mystery. I've done one science fiction literary novel, Memory, mm-hmm. which most people don't recognize as such.
Right.
I've done science fiction romance. I like the cross-fertilization aspects.
Yes.
The genre police have not yet arrested me for this, but I expect it any day. Ms. Bujol, do you know you were doing romance in a no-romance zone? Come along quietly now.
Your latest book in paperback is actually a mystery novel.
Seed of Ganda is very much a mystery.
Well, again, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, and we will have you back someday.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, @changesurfer.com.
Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.